Human Services Committee will come to order, please. We're going to start today with Senate Bill 452, and so I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 452. Senator Nelson, will you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 452. Who am I? Today I'm actually David Nelson, who is a state senator from Pendleton area, but I represent a county out there, Wild County, and I have presented to you testimony from a Jeff Harmon, who is a licensed mental health counselor in Wild County, who is in support of this bill, and he asked me to read this bill. He said it was a 400-mile trip one way, and he thought that probably he had better work to do than maybe come down here. I hope that doesn't offend the committee any, but he didn't think that 800-mile round trip in one day when he had other things going on. So he asked me to come testify for him. And there's a copy of the letter, and I'm not going to read the letter, but I just want to hit some of the high points that he's talking about. Is, you know, the purpose of this is to ask for licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to be put into the mental health provider pool. What he believes is an unnecessary hardship for Oregonians, particularly in rural areas, that we're not able to do this, and that they are not part of this pool. And he provides his example from Wallowa County. There's two therapists in Wallowa County, and both are LPCs, and one is in private practice, I think that's him, and the other is a clinical director in a community mental health center. And he told me the story today was one of the things that's happening to him is that he has one of his clients as a teacher. And under the teacher's insurance, if the teacher went to the county mental health, it would get paid. If it comes to him as a private counselor, he can't get paid. And so the teacher's situation is that the teacher's afraid that, you know, people in the community will know that he's got a problem of some sort, and there will be patients, maybe only some of his students, that are in the same waiting room with him and want to know why he's there. And so he's thinking of just a sense of confidentiality and fairness in the community, small community like Wallowa County, is that this would be very, very beneficial if you could be covered in that pool. He talks about SAFE being involved as accepting these things and several other states. Talks about cost effectiveness of this and that actually that this does give service and access to mental health care in rural areas that is really very crucial. Particularly, you know, there's about 7,000 people live in Wallowa County. You have two mental health counselors. So it's an access issue. It's a fairness issue. And with that, I would entertain any questions. And don't ask me any technical ones because he's the mental health counselor. And I'm sure there are lots of folks in the audience that can answer some of these questions if you...
Thank you. Questions? Okay.
Oh, thank you. You guys are wonderful people.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ivan Frazier.
Yes, sir.
Went for Jeff Harmon. Yes.
May I explain that?
Would you sit down and introduce yourself, please?
Okay. I'm Ivan Frazier, 3475 Browns Creek Road in the Dalles, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I was going to do for Jeff's got lots of coverage today. So he talked to Senator Nelson, which I'm happy that he did present for him.
Okay.
Otherwise, if there was no one, I was going to do that for him. I'm the current president of the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association, and that's the connection with Jeff. I'm also an LPC and an MFT. So, I think I'll just read this, and is that the appropriate thing to do?
Was that from Jeff Harmon?
No, do you have one from Jeff Harmon?
Well, if you could kind of highlight it, that would be good.
Okay.
Do we have a copy of it?
You have a copy.
Okay. Yeah.
And Senator Nelson gave you the highlights of Jeff's testimony. Mm-hmm. And again, he's in Joseph and Sergeant Peter.
Well, I don't want you to read. You have a different letter that you're going to discuss.
Yes.
Yes, okay. If you could just kind of discuss it, that would be good.
Okay, okay. Well, I've said who I am, and I come here in support of what Jeff Harmon has testified through Senator Nelson, and I also come in support of other LPCs and LMFTs that testify in support of the passage of SB 452. Now, I'd ask you to consider the following, if I may, including LPCs and MFTs in the mandated provider pool enables Oregonians who choose LPCs and LMFTs for their mental health care or counseling to use their health care benefits to help pay the cost of their care. I think you heard Senator Nelson talk about what happens in the far reaches in Wallowa County that, with the insurance company there. This is especially important for rural Oregon, where sometimes LPCs and LMFTs are the only available providers. Number two, LPCs and LMFTs are qualified providers who meet standards for training and experience designated by Oregon statutes. These standards meet or exceed the standards for providers who are currently in the mandated provider pool. LPCs work in virtually every community mental health center in the state, many in supervisory positions. I'm in such a position. LPCs and LMFTs are cost-effective providers. By including them in the mandated provider pool, it will have the effect of providing more care for less dollars. Oregon State employees and covered family members can be seen. I think Senator Nelson talked about that particular thing, that their LPCs and LMFTs have been excluded in the mandated pool. And that's very bothersome, particularly in rural areas. Licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists subscribe to a code of ethics set forth by the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. Many of them also subscribe to the codes of ethics of their professional associations, such as the American Mental Health Counselors Association and the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Including LPCs and LMFTs to the mandated provider pool will provide a greater choice to Oregon consumers seeking mental health care. May I respectfully urge you to move this bill with a recommendation to pass. Thank you. Have any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Robert Lungblad, James Maurer, and John Powell, would you all come up? Please, John, are you here?
I'm Rob Lundblad.
Okay. I don't see John.
Hello, I'm James Moores.
Hi. Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, for the record, my name is Robert Lundblad. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in the state of Oregon. I'm on the board of directors of the Oregon Psychological Association and work at the state hospital, as well as maintain a private practice here in Salem. And I'm here to testify with concern, I guess, regarding passage of this legislation. And if I might proceed?
Yes.
Is that all right with you? I guess I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable because I don't want this to become kind of what might appear to be a turf battle between different types of mental health professionals. And it's not. It's just we're concerned as psychologists regarding the protection of the people of the state of Oregon, making sure that those that are given kind of the state mandate or the legislative mandate to provide psychotherapy, diagnostic services to the people of the state of Oregon are trained, and that the background that they receive both from their licensing requirements as well as their supervision requirements meet the task of providing psychotherapy for mental disorders. The rules that cover licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage counselors do not require that they have training in diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. Although certainly some of them are adept at this, as a group they are required to have that sort of training, nor does the national licensure examination cover such items. The practice of counseling has to do with, as I remember one of my professors telling me, that it deals with people's assets, whereas the practice of clinical psychology and psychiatry deal with deficits or problems people have in life, which is what is required to meet the necessity for most insurance compensation. Somebody has a medical necessity or a medical emergency. It's not a counseling emergency. And I think that there's a, because it's, I supervise a counselor in training now, and I've discussed their training, and in many cases current counseling schools do provide some understanding of diagnostic and psychotherapy practices, but there's probably more than 1,000, maybe 1,200 licensed family therapists or licensed professional counselors in Oregon that would have to meet some sort of standard to at least in our opinion, so that their practice would meet the practice as designated by the others noted, the psychologists, psychiatrists, and licensed clinical social workers. As and I've, this is kind of a late career choice for me. I've been a licensed psychologist for 2 years, and I think I've really come to appreciate the balance and the tension between training and licensing requirements, as well as that part which is important for the protection of the people of the state of Oregon. That there's kind of a, the legislature plays kind of a gatekeeper in a way, but also a plays a role of making sure that those that fall into, into the, I think as a former speaker said, kind of the mental health provider pool reach a standard so that the protection of the people of the state of Oregon is at the utmost. I think in reading the legislation over this past week and over the weekend, it seems that something could be done to that, to make it clear and a requirement that those that are currently licensed and future licensed psychologists or marriage therapists and professional counselors would meet that criteria in the future of kind of the minimum standard for the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. But as of now, the way the law is written, it merely opens a door and directs insurance companies to reimburse for the same activity, although it may not be under the same auspices. Give an example that someone may be trained, be able to buy a book, go to a training session, and learn how to deliver a certain sort of therapy, but it doesn't make them clear, from the licensing standards that they understand how to deliver that therapy. Whereas within psychology, and that's all I can really speak of is psychology, that there's a requirement that anything that we do, that we have to pretend, we have to practice within our areas of competencies, which includes training, supervision, and certification.
Excuse me. If somebody has their BlackBerry on, if you would please turn off your cell phone or BlackBerry. It's reverberating. I'm sorry.
So, in essence, that kind of completes my testimony. I'm certainly willing to answer any questions you might have.
So, the competency level is not uniformly there under the current licensing?
That's correct. That there's different areas that are, for somebody to be a psychiatrist requires them to be a medical doctor as well as pass boards. For somebody to be a psychologist, they've got to complete certain training, lengthier training than a professional counselor, and also covers areas including psychopathology, psychopharmacology, other aspects of that relate directly to the treatment of mental disorders, whereas counseling requirements, as I read in the rules today, talks about using therapeutic relationships, understanding people's problems. I didn't delve into the actual requirements for training, but it's more, it doesn't discuss the matters of diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders specifically.
Yes, Senator Bridger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may have misunderstood you, but did you say that you have been a psychologist for 2 years?
Licensed. Licensed psychologist for 2 years.
Could you tell me what your background was prior to that?
I was an unlicensed resident for 3 years, which means it's kind of the period after graduation from a doctoral program, but before passing both the oral and written exams in Oregon, practiced as a psychologist resident. And then prior to that, I was going to school for a long time, and then during that time, I also worked as a forester, which is another story entirely.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Jim Moores from Beaverton area. I'm currently a doctoral student in clinical psychology at George Fox University. I think Dr. Lundblad has presented many of the points I would talk about, but I did want to come forth and just put forth a question or some thoughts in my mind from a personal level. I know he's talked about the more technical things, how this would affect me as an individual in the state. So what had happened in the past 3 months is my sister was experiencing some difficulty with her daughter. And she came to me and said, okay, you know, we've been having some family difficulties. My daughter's kind of stressed out, and my ex-husband is involved, and we're trying to negotiate this all. Jim, you know, you're going through this psychology program to become a licensed psychologist. Can you give me some referrals? So I talked around to the people I know and got a referral for a licensed professional counselor and also for a psychologist, and gave her the referrals. Because I thought, you know, it's just one of those family strife things. And she contacted one of the people. Later on after Christmas, we began to talk again and talk about her daughter. And as she started to talk more, and she hadn't seen either the psychologist or the professional counselor yet, as she started to talk, it sounded more and more to me like depression. And I was getting worried because she said, well, you know, she's... You know, she might be having some suicidal thoughts. So in my mind, that changed how things would be interacting. I was thinking, you know, there's no difference between your psychologist and your professional counselor if you're just going to talk about some family problems. But what cued in my mind is, okay, do both these professionals have the ability to recognize and diagnose this depression? Especially if it's suicidal. And then would they be able to present that information to a primary care provider who would prescribe medication for that? And personally, my thought was, yeah, I know the psychologist is going to be able to refer and say, you know what, I've diagnosed this as depression. I think that medication would help this person in coordination with therapy because that's a best practice model. And I was unsure whether that could be done also from a professional counselor perspective to be saying, I've diagnosed this as depression. I think some medications would be helpful. So there was that level of care, and then thinking, well, okay, if this is the case, is my sister and her daughter going to have to seek out another professional? Are they not only going to have to go to the professional counselor for therapy, but are they going to have to seek out a psychiatrist or someone else to give the diagnosis, or a psychologist, a diagnosis of depression so they can get their medical needs met? Thank
you. Good point. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. I guess John Paul just missed his opportunity to speak forever. So no, time is up. Time is statute of him. You can get him now. Okay. While we're waiting for John Paul, Carol Bolwig and Anna Bradley.
Berardi,
yeah. Would you come up, please? And if John ever shows up, he can take that other chair there. Introduce you. Okay, John. John Powell, you may come up now, please. We called your name four times, and you know you were gone. I told you you should go home, and I thought maybe you decided to leave.
But running for office, I'd appreciate that.
Okay, John. You can be part of this panel. Go ahead and who started to introduce themselves? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Carol Bolwig, and I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I practice in Tillamook County. I worked at the Community Mental Health Center there for 10 years, working with all kinds of different mental illnesses, and also diagnosed people with chronic mental illnesses, people with adjustment disorders, people with borderline personality disorders. I also, in my coursework at Portland State to get my master's, I took a 3-hour class in diagnoses. And the LPC board, the Board of Professional Counselors and Therapists, they have a very, in Oregon, have a very strict setup for the different coursework that you needed to take in order to become an LPC. And you also needed to have at the time, and I think it's even increased from when I got my license, I think it was 2,400 hours of supervision. I received that supervision from psychologists, from psychiatrists, from MSWs, and from LPCs. My experience in the field is there are people who don't practice well in all three of those with all three of those licenses, and there are wonderful people out there. And you will find in any community mental health center in this state, you will find LPCs doing that kind of work. I currently work for Oregon Youth Authority. I work with adolescent sex offenders. I guess I want to say that I do believe that I do believe in SB 452 across the board. I think it is true that the rural areas need it more. I am from the Tillamook area. The amount of choices that our constituents have isn't that great, and I would like to see it be expanded to include the LPCs if the LPCs should choose to go into private practice. So I guess the other thing I would say is my training, both the training that I received, which also there's an accreditation process, KCREP accreditation, which the different universities need to go through to make sure that we're up to standards. The LPC board, the Board of Professional Counselors and Therapists, are very, they make it absolutely sure that we who get our licenses have met numerous requirements to become therapists. So.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Questions? Okay. Go ahead.
My name is Anna Berardi. Thank you, Chairman Morissette, for allowing us to speak today. I am an associate professor of marriage and family therapy at George Fox University, and my job there is to educate and train individuals preparing to become professional counselors and marriage and family therapists, and hopefully they will move on to becoming licensed professionals. One of my jobs is to make sure that each graduate has displayed the clinical competencies of assessment, diagnosis, and treatment, and they have to display that competency both in writing and in the form of video of their work. And that project, we call that a clinical master's thesis. We have licensed professionals from all the various licensed professions that this person just spoke of participate in actually evaluating our students' work to make sure that they are displaying those competencies as they are mandated to do by state licensure and the professional organizations. And I have just two comments I want to make today. The first one is actually what I just spoke of. We do expect our students to display competencies in assessment, diagnosis, and treatment. And secondly, I ask that you let these professionals, when they become licensed, let them do their job. Please let them do their job. We hold them to very tight standards. They pay a lot of money for this training with hopes of establishing a professional life that can pay their bills. And then they get out there in the workforce and they find that there are prejudicial barriers that prevent them from doing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I've been before this committee before and expressed our opposition to mandates, particularly at this particular time. As you know, a mental health parity bill passed last session, went into effect January 1st of this year, and adjustments are being made to each policy that's renewed. If the committee decides to go ahead with this particular legislation, we would ask, one, that the wording in the bill come into compliance with the language in Senate Bill 1. And in that legislation, it gave insurers the right to manage claims and to contract, in essence, with panels or providers. This bill, as written, does not do that. And so we would request that be amended. The other major problem with the language in the bill is the bill relating to reimbursement, where it talks about the usual and customary fee in an area served, and we do not determine rates on that basis. We have no format in which to gather that kind of information. And so we would simply ask, Mr. Chairman, that first of all, we be allowed to work with Senate Bill 1, implement that, and get it in all of the policies, which are renewing this year. And secondly, if you do decide to go ahead with this bill, there's no way we can contract with another discipline without it costing money, both administratively and on the benefit side. So it will increase costs, and that's great. Some people get all of their ills treated perfectly in their community, while others lose their insurance totally and have absolutely no coverage for anything. So it's a balancing act, and we understand that. And we would hope that, again, if you do decide to go forward with the bill, that we be allowed to approach you with amendments.
Okay. Good. Questions? Thanks. Thank you all. Thank you. Marcus Berglund and Gina Nickel, would you come up, please?
Good afternoon.
Who wants to start?
Chair Morissette, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And for the record, we would just like to say that we are in wholeheartedly support of Senate Bill 452 for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that this bill actually doesn't help community mental health programs, because if you're a licensed professional counselor, a licensed clinical social worker, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist working at a community mental health program, you are covered by insurance. But this does go to community choice, and it's not only for the rural areas, but it's also for the metropolitan areas. My experience has been that your degree doesn't make the person. And what I mean by that is that there are some great social workers and some that are not so great. There are some great licensed professional counselors and some that are not so great. That's like that in every discipline. I do have to say, in the order of full disclosure, that once upon a time, even though I have let my license lapse, I was a licensed professional counselor. We are trained. I'm glad to see that Carol is in the audience. We are trained with a number of hours. We are fully capable of diagnosis. And, in fact, in many clinics, LPCs supervise the licensed clinical social worker and psychologist, depending on experience and number of years experience in the different clinics. It makes sense to me in the experience that I've had with all these disciplines that you have to treat them equally, and I would just ask that you act on Senate Bill 452. If they're licensed and they provide the service, they should be treated fairly, both in a community mental health program as well as letting them hang out their private shingle. Thank you.
You did mention rural health having a greater need.
Well, rural health is hard to get psychiatrists, psychologists, licensed clinical social workers, or licensed professional counselors there. So I think opening the field up to whoever is in the area of any four of those disciplines are helpful. And in some rural areas, you can't find any or all of the disciplines. So I think having a variety to choose from should be up to you and I as people to choose who we go to for services.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Okay. Hi, I'm Marcus Berglund. I'm the president-elect at the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. And actually, I see myself much more as a clinician and practitioner of 15 years in the field of marriage and family therapy, as well as teaching and training supervisees and marriage and family therapy students in three of the four marriage and family therapy programs in the state. I must say, too, similar to Gina, most of my professional life has been in an agency setting, which this bill won't necessarily or directly affect those at all. However, it has much to do with what we do in the profession of the mental health services and being a mental health qualified practitioner. Number one, I've kind of been sidetracked by some of the comments that have been made, and for the record, just from my perspective, both LPC and LMFT are fully trained, and I think this bears repeating since it was charged that we are not, in assessment and diagnosing and treatment of mental health disorders. Marriage and family therapy as a field has been recognized by the federal government since 1968 for doing just that. Champus and TRICARE in 1968 started covering marriage and family therapy services to its active duty uniformed personnel, and that has been added to by the Department of Defense and other venues, Department of Education, Department of Transportation. I could go on. There's about 9 or 10 federal entities, departments/agencies that recognize mental health services as provided by licensed marriage and family therapists. That doesn't mean they don't recognize LPCs. I can only speak to the MFT ends of things. I would also vary to say, speaking of your concern, Senator Morissette, in the rural areas, there's a federal agency that is set up just to do that, to identify the health, mental health, and general medical pool of practitioners, and that is the Health Resources and Services Administration. They have designated 85% of the shortage, professional shortage areas in mental health are in rural areas across this country. Oregon has 26 rural counties. This fact is going to be compounded with the growing meth epidemic, with returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. By the way, conservatively now, fully 20% of those returning from Iraq have been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I would venture to say that is very conservative, especially the style of warfare that's being fought there. From a marriage and family therapy perspective, we see things holistically. We see things connected. I don't treat a returning soldier or a batterer or a victim of sexual abuse in isolation. I certainly will diagnose them as a mental health disorder if it warrants, if they meet criteria for that, but I will also look at that person's problems in the context of relationships. So I'll be looking at family members. I'll be looking at co-workers. We'll bring them into sessions. We'll bring in children if the identified client is an adult. If the identified client is a suicidal child, we'll certainly bring in those people who are significant in that person's life. The latest research is growing in terms of adding a relational component to the treatment of mental health disorders. Not to disparage any testimony here, but the kind of offhanded remark that, oh, they just had some family problem, speaks to me that the vast misunderstanding and truly a slippery slope to classify something as just a family problem, that kind of family problem is what things like massacre shootings at schools to happen. There is so much more that needs to be done from a mental health perspective that can be provided and are being provided in agencies by mental health counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists. I would also like to say that it is indeed a great privilege to bear witness to people trying to overcome some of the most horrific things you'd ever want to experience. So this is a very humbling profession. And I echo Professor Berardi's plea to let people practice what they've been trained to do. And marriage and family therapy, the national organization, the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, dictates that there needs to be certain components to even become a clinical member as an MFT, such as diagnosing and treating. If their demand wasn't there, I would still make this argument, but the fact is that we are on a crash course for a crisis in terms of a mental health meltdown in terms of services being provided, and that is especially acute in rural areas. And just in wrapping up, let me make sure I covered things here. Also, the National Advisory Committee on Rural Health and Human Services, in their report to the Secretary of Health and Human Services in 2004, recommended that the Medicare, largest third-payer insurance payer in the country, should expand mental health professionals to include MFTs and professional counselors. Also, I wanted to make clear this does not expand scope of practice to answer the esteemed psychology testimony here. This has nothing to do with scope of practice. We do what we're trained to do, and this is when an insurance company is offering covered psychotherapy services anyway, then all of those people, as licensed by the state of Oregon, should have the right to practice, and those clients who are in great need should have the right to choose their practitioner as long as they are in good standing with the state of Oregon. That's a key misinterpretation often, that we're trying to expand scope of practice. That is not a part of this law. The other key part, which is in your information sheet that I gave you, 23 states already have vendorship laws, and actually three of those states are even more stringent in covering what's called AWPs, all willing providers, that are even more stringent in terms of we have a therapy service to be covered, literally everybody who is licensed. This vendorship bill that's before your panel is not quite as stringent as that, and I'm not well versed in insurance to know what the little loopholes are, but the AWP is the most stringent kind of coverage that's in your packet there. In terms of costs, let me close by saying, in the last 5 years, there have been a number of states that have looked at this issue, and I plead with you to not reinvent the wheel and looking at what these states have found. The state of Maine had the most recent, and that was in 2005. They found that 0.01% was the impact on premiums by covering licensed marriage and family therapists and professional counselors in the state of Maine. Massachusetts found a similar finding. In fact, they didn't even put a number on it. They just said it was so negligible, we can't put a number on it. And percentages of claims, as you will see in your sheet, in North Carolina, in Virginia, in Texas, all found to be negligible. So when we talk about costs, what are the real costs? Those are the real costs in the here and now. I would ask, what are the costs for not providing mental health services? What are the costs to our children, to our future children? Native Americans looked at, in making their decisions, seven generations down the road, down the line. What are we doing to our future generations by not treating a felt need that you know will be cross-generationally transmitted? A great chance, if you go to jails and look at those incarcerated for violent crimes, almost to a T, they've been abused in some way by their family members or those close to them, people they knew. Not stranger violence, but people they knew. This is key. This is again speaks to what are the costs by not acting. So I would say that the citizens of Oregon deserve the best care that we can provide, and I would say this doesn't even solve the problem, but it certainly is a step in the right direction, and I thank you for humbly hearing me out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions? Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
That is the extent of the people who signed up to speak. And we do not have the votes to pass this bill out. I think it needs more work. I think the bill needs more work. And so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 452. And we will open the public hearing on SJR 21. We have the sheet. Yeah, and I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 617. We'll do them together.
Now you're confusing me.
Well, one is...
Oh. Just kidding, Bill. I was confused before I got here.
Yeah, well, okay. I'm in a state of potential.
Well, yeah, there is that.
Okay. We can do both of them, but we do want to pass, if possible, the SJR out. There doesn't seem to be a lot of conflict with that. The other may need some amendments. Go ahead. Would you like to start and give us
sure.
your name, please?
My name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. And actually, before I start, I want to state that due to some drafting errors, this bill was written as being out of developmentally disabled, the DD and mental health arenas, and it was our intent that it would be out of public health and epidemiology. And we have some conceptual amendments that we've worked out with the Department of DHS, and that's in your packet that you'll be getting. And also just to go over real quickly the bills, because we have a couple of speakers that have a time limit, so
okay.
I'm going to wait for my testimony until after they've spoken. But basically, Senate Bill 617 would create a registry to track TBI and to explore a brain injury waiver mm-hmm. and to provide resource facilitation for outreach into the brain injury community and returning veterans, as well as doing educational training to the medical professional community and training to the military as well on how to identify brain injury.
Okay.
So at this time, I am going to let General Caldwell come forward.
General Caldwell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Welcome, General Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department, and I snagged the Director of the Veterans Affairs Department of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in the hallway and thought it was appropriate that if I was going to speak on this issue, that certainly that Mr. Willis would have probably equal or more time to discuss it than myself. 617 is... certainly, we have a grave concern about some of the injuries that we're seeing that do come back from the current conflicts that we've been involved with in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's indisputable that some of the tactics being used against our soldiers are extremely detrimental to what's been, you know, to their brain injuries, particularly with IEDs. These things are so forceful that even though the capsules of these vehicles have been armored up and secured to try to prevent death, still the impact is so great that many, many times these soldiers do sustain injuries, that some of which are not readily identifiable. And they don't manifest themselves till after, you know, sometime afterwards. Some of them, of course, do manifest themselves immediately. To give you an idea of what we've tried to do with the Oregon National Guard soldiers is, thanks to the good graces of Senator White and Senator Smith, 2 years ago, they had an earmark that, that brought $400,000 worth of Oregon Aero helmet inserts, which have been identified and seen throughout the military forces, to help prevent this catastrophic brain injury. And we've outfitted all of our soldiers with those apparatuses, and we think that perhaps we're doing what we can to try to send them, when they do deploy, with the proper equipment so to prevent such an injury.
Excuse me, General. Do other troops have that kind of protection? I mean, other than what you're talking about?
Mr. Right, Chairman, the Army has, initially, no. Initially, as the war began, that was not the case. They had a webbed helmet that was basically very protective with respect to direct fire, but these impacts of these IEDs, particularly the high explosive nature of them, were such that they actually ended up hurting the soldiers more than they helped them with respect to that type of injury. The Army has gone forward and gone with an insert that goes into all helmets, but as in good federal government fashion, Department of Defense fashion, the lowest bidder wins. And the lowest bidder on these things weren't quite as good as what we find this Oregon company producing. And many of our soldiers were taking them out when they got the Rapid Fielding Initiative after they deployed. They were taking them out. They were sending emails back, telephone calls back, saying, can you get me the Oregon Aero insert? And so we were literally boxing these things up and sending them to Iraq here a couple of years ago to outfit these helmets. So right now, I can't tell you 100% of our people in Afghanistan have these, but the majority of them do. If they don't have them, it's because they haven't asked for them, because we had the supply and we got them purchased through a, like I said, through a government contract, federal government contract, after a good deal of consternation because it was not the low bid. And we had to justify the non-low bid, but we know that all the research has shown that this particular apparatus that we're using now, that Oregon Aero produces, is far better, has a far better ballistic quality, has a far more comfort level for the soldiers, and it does just a lot better job than what the lower bidder is being able to produce. So we're making strides every chance we can to try to make sure that we do what we can before these soldiers leave, so they leave with that apparatus in their helmet when they leave Oregon.
Now, do you have evidence that the type of helmet has indeed saved people from serious brain injury?
Mr. Chairman, there are several research reports out that are available in the public that have proven that or have made that claim. I'm not a physician and certainly not an expert on brain injuries, but from what I read in the public domain, indeed this has been very helpful and very very good apparatus to help these folks. So that's the basis of my knowledge on it.
And there's no indication that the government, the federal government, is going to follow suit with similar kind of protection for their troops?
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the general press and what's out there, and I can tell you that there are several organizations that are pressing hard for this, for this particular product. I think the Marine Corps has pretty much exclusively gone to this product, is what I've been told, and I suspect that as time goes on, we'll see that happen. But I would venture to say that the majority of the American soldiers that are in the combat theater do not have that particular helmet.
Now, we're talking Oregon National Guard troops that have that helmet.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're talking about the folks that we have sent away, or sent off on deployment. We have provided that.
Okay, but not any...
Not the majority of the other soldiers in the United States.
Well, no, but other Oregon service people don't have that helmet if they're...
I would venture to say that they do not.
No, okay. Good. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, go ahead and continue.
Well, I'll just conclude by saying that, I know that the Department of Human Resources has some suggestions that they want to add to this thing, and I know that I spoke with some of their folks earlier today, and they certainly are concerned about this. And I think from our standpoint, I guess we don't treat our soldiers when they come home. We don't have that capability, and we don't have that kind of infrastructure. Our soldiers come home with an injury, then they stay on federal active duty, and they're typically treated by the Army. Well, they most generally are, unless they're discharged, in which case then they become the responsibility of the Veterans Affairs. Mr. Willis, sitting on my left, his agency advocates for our veterans, and I'll let him tell you more about it. But the bottom line is that we go to Jim Willis and ODVA and say, we've got a problem. This particular individual is no longer in our charge and keeping because they've been discharged because of their injuries. And then it's up to Jim to make sure that they get into the Veterans Affairs and get the treatment. I can tell you that we've been very successful in working with our people, with our reintegration team that we established, came to this body in 2005 and asked for state resources. The federal government did not step up. They are now. They're starting to step up, but they didn't then. We recognized we had 700-800 folks coming home that had been in traumatic situations, and we needed to step up and make sure that we didn't dump 700 or 800, or actually more than that, almost 1,200 soldiers in a two-year period on 36 county mental health programs and expect them to take care of it. We just knew that we were going to have a problem. So by establishing that program, we were able to integrate with not only the providers, both local, state, and federal, but also integrate with Jim and his department and identify these soldiers with issues and get them to the proper care to the federal government, who is responsible for treating them. I'll tell you right now, and I think Jim would echo it, they got a long way to go, the Veterans Affairs Department does, to get their act together to make sure our people can get the kind of treatment they need in a timely fashion. But it's a whole lot better than it was 2 years ago. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that people like this legislature got together and pushed, and people like Jim Willis pushed, and we pushed, and our elected leaders in the state of Oregon have done the same. So I would say that we're probably in better shape than a lot of states, if I had to guess. I think Jim can verify that. But from what I've read and heard, or our guys are getting better treatment and getting quicker than they would say if they were in the Northeast. And I'll conclude with that.
Could you give us, the committee, some specs on that helmet?
Mr. Chairman, we can provide that. I don't know if anybody from Morgan Arrow came here today or not, but I can pull one off the shelf and bring you in an example if you'd like to see it.
Well, that and also maybe a picture with the specifications and what makes this a better helmet and the whole bit.
Here is a... I'll just pass this to the committee, but...
They have it in your packet.
Oh.
In the newsletter.
I see. Okay.
If you look at the example of the helmet...
I see. Okay.
The brain bucket, that's nothing more than a web, leather strap and web.
I see. Okay.
If you look at the one on the right, and a good example is like a football helmet. It's very tight. It's very, very secure. The product, Oregon Arrow produces, allows it to breathe. It has a ballistic quality to it. And it really does make a difference so your neck doesn't get sore. That was the...
Okay.
You feel like one of these little dolls in the back of somebody's car with a bobblehead,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If you wear the brain bucket, by the end of the day, that's what your head feels like. If you wear the other system, the Oregon Arrow system, the Bliss kit, you know, you hardly notice that your helmet's been on all day. It's so well secured.
And it withstands the impact of...
Correct.
Yeah. And
it doesn't give it that opportunity for your head to rattle around inside that shell.
Is there any difference in the strength of the helmet itself in terms of penetration?
Mr. Chairman, no. The helmet is basically the same, the Kevlar grade, and it has its ballistic qualities as well. The difference in the helmet that you see now, if you're watching TV and you see soldiers that are in combat, they've reshaped the helmet to make it, you know, more fitting so you can actually use your weapon. The old helmets had a tendency to kind of drop down, had a little brim on them, and it became real difficult for you to use your weapon, plus put your night vision sight on the front of it. So they've done some reshaping of the helmet, but the quality of the helmet is very good quality. The ballistic qualities of the Kevlar, far superior to anything we've seen up till now.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, General.
Senator Morsett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'll just be brief in my comments about traumatic brain injury. and tell you very simply that what many of these mental health professionals here today already know, and that is without the proper screening and diagnosis, often TBI is seen as PTSD. And so when misdiagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder, it simply puts off the treatment that would in fact work toward making the military member well sooner or put them on a track for better treatment. Last week, the United States Secretary of Veterans Affairs instructed that all 156 medical centers will put an enhanced screening methodology in place to better recognize TBI in all the returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq. Currently, they get 2 years of health care immediately on their discharge from the military service. Another way to say that might be that they go to the head of the line. And so the chance of discovering this kind of injury by using all 156 of the medical centers across the nation are better than it has been, and the ability of them to do referrals to one of the 15 polytrauma centers in the system would occur from the major medical centers to the centers for those that need more detailed treatment. The challenge with traumatic brain injury in a military environment is that because of the concussive nature of the explosions that are occurring over there, it is very possible that you will not see a physical injury to the soldier, as an example. But in fact, they have just as easily suffered a concussion. But the offshoot of that concussion are some of the very same symptoms that are associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, when in fact they're suffering from a brain injury. And so I am very encouraged by the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, their recognition that they need to do more in this area. And I think what we need to do is look at what that more is as it relates to what Senate Bill 617 hopes to accomplish. And by marrying those two efforts together, I think we can do a better job for the military folks that would come in contact with the Oregon Brain Injury Services as provided by our state. And that would conclude my remarks, Senator.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Boquist, Representative Boquist, would you come up, please? You don't have your helmet on today.
For the record, I'm State Representative Brian Boquist. Mr. Chair, I serve the 23rd House District. Good to see you, Senator Verger. And as you well know, Mr. Chair, you and I are chief co-sponsors on this, on both of these bills. I want to keep my comments brief so that I don't, you know, step on something and need my helmet back over in the House. Since we're a little bit more of a ruckus raisers over there than you esteemed ladies and gentlemen are on the Senate side.
Give us time.
Yeah. I do want to comment, make a comment and give my gratitude to the military department who has stepped outside of the box to help veterans and soldiers in purchasing equipment that, for better word, is unregulation, but helps our deploying National Guard members. I also want to thank the State Department of Veterans Affairs and Jim Willis and their efforts and the efforts of the County Veterans Service Officers that go out and try and acquire the mental health care assistance and the funding to support veterans that have these injuries. A word of caution, though, Mr. Chair and distinguished members, is that the Veterans Administration, in my personal and professional opinion last week, launched this new program out of political pressure, and it is not in the existing budget. So while the Fed is promising more, the reality is yet to be defined at some point in the future. As you know, Mr. Cherry, I mean, I think we both signed on to SGR 21 and to bring attention to the issue that we have before us. One of the problems we have on a day-to-day basis in things from traffic accidents and individuals who suffer traumatic injuries, we're familiar with. However, the fact of the matter is that we know at least 30% of the returning veterans that are coming in from overseas seek mental health care upon their redeployment. Much of that is done in our local communities simply because we don't have the resources, or they don't even understand the resources exist and where to get them. I suspect that that's going to expand. The second issue is, and I did catch you, Mr. Chair, mentioning on my way down that there are some amendments to SB 617, which I'm familiar with, too. I look forward to the fact that both of these bills, in one form or the other, or the resolutions, will come to the House, and I will do my part in the House to bring light, one, to the issue, and, two, to help not only those Oregonian citizens that need help that aren't in the military, but to help those veterans that are returning from a very traumatic situation over there. One last parting comment, and then I may take any questions, is I have physically worn both the helmets and the inserts. The Special Operations troops actually had them long before anybody else had them. I do know that those civil affairs units from the state of Oregon that used to be in Special Operations before they were transferred out a year ago may in fact have these helmets, and I do know that the Marine Corps reservists that are deploying presently have these helmets and some of the inserts. So to some degree there's a good news story. The bad news story is that even at certain levels of concussion, when 5 155 millimeter rockets go off next to you in an IED, we're still going to have injury regardless of the helmets. And that's of course the direction we're trying to go with SGR 21 and SB 617. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Boquist. There was a piece on the news the other night about a soldier who had several concussions and was taken to a hospital and recovered each time to go back into battle. And so, you know that football, there are a number of football players from Oregon who played in the pros who ended up with concussions, and pretty soon you have to quit, otherwise you do have permanent brain damage. And so I guess the question is, diagnosing people on the field as to whether or not they are in imminent danger of serious brain damage, and then how long does it take when the people come back? This is not an easy thing to diagnose, always. I mean, sometimes it takes a while before the symptoms kicking in and you really know that there is brain damage. So, comments?
Thank you, sir. A comment from practical experience that I've observed, and I'm no scientist by any means, you're talking generally a minimum of about 18 months before you even start to see many of these signs, especially those that are simply jarred around, as you could say, or thrown around in combat. The other thing I would point out is that despite, I guess, or regardless of the opinion of the situation that we're presently facing in Iraq, the medical community has gone a tremendous, tremendous ways in battlefield treating of casualties. And so what has transpired, interestingly enough, is that many of the individuals, frankly, that would be dead are no longer being killed because of the force protection issues. And so we're now traveling into a new era of frankly not understanding what the ramifications are, because you have individuals that are literally wearing full body protective armor. I've had men in my own command have the entire chest plate and steel ceramic plate shot off the front of their vest in combat and lived without a scratch other than bruises on their chests. Obviously, I've had them banged up all over the place wearing these helmets also. And so I think the medical community is going to have a rude awakening, in my opinion, at some point in the near future when we bring all of these individuals home. I think we're going to find the long-term impacts to be much greater than we've ever seen in another conflict. Now, the good news is the short-term impacts is there's less killed. The bad news is a lot of these mental health issues and other issues are going to manifest themselves 18 months, 2 years, 3 years in front of us, and unfortunately, they're going to fall in our lap as a state, as a county, or as a city, and not in the lap of the federal government.
Good. Questions, comments?
Just a comment.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree that the services I do not feel are adequate for those coming back. And as a public health nurse, I had to serve some. As a public health nurse, there were some complaints of people, and it turned out that they were vets. This was back in the early 80s, and they were 10 years out of the Vietnam War, and they were having issues and needed to be referred right back into the VA hospital and taken care of. But we have a long ways to go, I agree.
This kind of reminds me of the... I've been working on a tsunami bill and a brain injury registry bill for the same number of sessions from 2001. And the tsunami bill had a teachable moment with what happened in Sumatra, and now I think that we are having a teachable moment now on this brain injury problem because of what is happening both on the news about brain injury and the fact that we're aware of all of the problems with identifying a brain injury, because it does take time. And so hopefully this is the year that we're going to move this bill. We've worked long and hard, and the registry is extremely important. So I'm hoping we can get the amendments and move that out. So,
and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to it coming to my side of the chamber where we will pass it out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sherry, you're orchestrating this. Who should we have up next? You're in charge, Sherry.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do my testimony real quickly. And since most of my testimony has already been used by other people, I'm just cover real quickly SJR 21 would designate March as Brain Injury Awareness Month each year. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've gotten an amendment or a proclamation from the governor. And this March, we have one also from the governor. This would just make it in legislation. It's already being done in New Jersey. There's no physical impact. It would just brain injury awareness is already done throughout the state. OHSU is very active in brain injury awareness lecture series and activities, and they support this bill also. The TBI registry, like I said, that would be housed in the Department of Epidemiology. Mm-hmm. This is our third or fourth try for that. And with the strength of the TBI registry is that you will be able to track the incidence, severity, outcomes, and costs to the state of Oregon and put in preventive measures. And because the only way to lower brain injuries is to put in is to prevent them through preventive measures. And in Oregon, we have approximately, according to the CDC, approximately 2% of the population has a traumatic brain injury. That would be a little over 72,000 Oregonians living with a disability from a traumatic brain injury. When you add in acquired brain injury, which is stroke, near drowning, spousal abuse, child abuse, and the other forms of brain injury, brain surgery and tumors, you have approximately 220,000 Oregonians living with a brain injury. When you include their family members, and I'm just going to take 4 family members per person, you're looking at over 1 million Oregonians are directly affected by brain injury. So this is a very very big problem to all Oregonians. And now we add in the returning vets. They're coming back. They're having behavioral problems from a brain injury. The spouses don't understand. What this bill will do, besides the registry, the resource facilitation will reach out and educate through the family assistance officers, the spouses of the returning vets, so that they can watch for these symptoms to be able to identify them sooner. We have someone that will be talking soon, and his wife and family are the ones that identified his injuries that he sustained in Iraq and a year and a half after his initial injuries. And so I'm going to there's one other thing that I wanted. I've created DVDs for each of you, my gift, and it's the Bob Woodruff presentations from talking about his experiences, and has some actual pictures.
Great.
So each of you will have that DVD, and I also have his book, which great book. I've read it. It's all set on the DVD, so now you don't need to read it. And so then we'll start with our people that we have, unless there's some questions for me.
I notice there's no fiscal.
No, that's not. That was a mistake. There, it's
referral. Okay. Well, I knew there would be a fiscal. What are we talking about here?
Well, I think the registry is approximately $350,000 biannually, and we think that the resource facilitation statewide would be about $450,000 biannually. So we're looking at, I think we've estimated $900,000 to $1 million biannually.
Is this basically what we've talked about before, $1 million? I think this is the amount that we've always talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And other states, Arizona,
There's 32 other states that have TBI registries at this time. Most of the eastern states and the midwestern states have active brain injury programs, so the brain injury resource facilitation is active in a big part of every state. Oregon is a little behind the times. Colorado has a huge brain injury program. In fact, they bring in so much money for brain injury that they're taking scholarships from Oregon that's for brain injury survivors to go to summer camp, and they will pay for it. And Arizona has an intensive brain injury program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Explain to me the purpose of the registry.
Yeah, the idea of a registry is to, there's quite a few things. One would be to track the people that sustain a brain injury. So, like if you, the same thing as they have a cancer registry. So, when you have cancer, they're tracking that. They know how many cases they're having. They know which areas they're having cancer in, so they can look and see if there's other reasons that are causing it with the, and also it's education. So you're educating the medical doctors and the EMTs and everyone working with them. And with the brain injury registry, that would be really important because right now people with brain injury will go into the emergency room, and we have some people going to give testimony here, that they'll go into the emergency room and the doctors say, wow, you're walking, you're talking, you're one of the lucky ones, you have no problem, and they can never practice their career again because they have sustained a brain injury, which made it so they can't multitask anymore. And they're tired all the time. The common problems that you have with a brain injury, with the registry, the education, and then identifying areas that are having problems. Like for instance, maybe there's a lot of accidents happening on one certain road, and ending up with some severe brain injuries from that. So they'll go in and they'll lower the speed limit. So the preventive measures, which are lowering speed limits, putting in speed bumps. The seatbelt law was put in because so many people were being ejected and sustaining a brain injury or dying. So there's quite a few preventive measures that can be put into play.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I have. First of all, Sherry Stock is incredible regarding brain injury. She's a guru of the state. She has conferences and has done a horrendous amount of work. So I want to thank you for that. I have another bill in for a birth defects registry also. And it seems like there are a number of things that we should be tracking. And if somehow we can work with DHS to combine these things, because the same thing is prevention, finding out where these people live, for one thing, seeing if there's a correlation, just a number of things. So I know that it costs money, but in the long run, it will help, I think, Oregon as a whole.
Yeah, Oregon already has a trauma registry, so I think having the funding that's why it isn't, you're not reinventing the wheel, it's already there. You're creating enough money to enable them to add more to it and add the tracking and the education component, which is a huge part of it. And, the other states that I've surveyed all the states, and the biggest part is the education component, which is built into this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Speaking of DHS, I think we'll move to DHS. Adriana Green and Lori Lindberg and Ellie, would you like to come up and join this? We'll have Ellie sit on the save the end spot over there for Ellie. Oh, Sherry, you got to move. Sorry about that, Sherry. Don't go far, though. Yeah. Why don't we let Ellie? Oh, okay. Good. Thank you, Sherry. And Ellie, would you like to give your testimony, please?
Okay, and I have some for you guys. Senator Morsett, members of the committee, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I give testimony in support of the registry and also, although we're not doing it, the Senate Joint Resolution 2, because I believe these are needed for, you know, the folks who have head injuries and are living with the results of that. I won't read my testimony because you have it, but over 40 years ago, I was in an accident and broke the headlight of a pickup out with the back part of my head and then was thrown up over the cab and landed in the dirt and received a spinal cord injury. And the only thing that was treated after 4 weeks in a coma was my spinal cord injury. And the head injury changed my life. I used to be good with spelling and numbers, and I'm now have a problem by turning things around. And burst of anger that I didn't have before, and just little things, short-term memory, 2 years gone, a lot of things that I would have appreciated having help with. And I know things are slowly changing, and I'm just here to advocate that they continue and that they be funded more readily.
Thank you, Ellie. At some point, were you diagnosed then with a brain injury at some point after that accident?
I don't know officially. I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think that's anywhere in my medical record, mm-hmm. although, you know, you can't be in a coma for almost a month.
Right. Okay. They, of course, that's something that was not looked at separately from the other injury.
Yeah.
And so if you appeared normal, then that was...
Yeah.
They did. Okay. But I'm wondering, though, as a result of the registry and as we move along on this, if there will be more specific diagnosis of brain injuries early on. I mean, that hopefully will be part of mm-hmm. where we're moving. So it isn't just if you look okay, you're fine. Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, you can't tell by looking.
Yeah.
If you listen after a while, you might, but if you know me, that not really.
Okay.
I appreciate being able to come as far as I have,
but most
of it has been on my own. And, you know, working through graduate school, getting a master's, and learning how to learn differently than I used to.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Thank you very much, Ellie. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Who wants to start?
I'll start. Thank you. Chair Morsett and members of the committee, I also won't read my testimony, but I'll read a few parts of it. I am Adrienne Green. I'm the coordinator of the Children's Injury Prevention Program housed in the Injury Prevention and Epidemiology section at DHS, which is public health in Portland. I'm here to testify on the bill in support of it. The department does wish to establish a traumatic brain injury registry. I think you know that in the U.S., TBI is the number one cause of both death and disability in children and young adults. There are 20 times more disabilities from brain injuries than AIDS, breast cancer, spinal cord injuries, and multiple sclerosis combined. And since 1977, brain injuries have claimed more lives than all U.S. wars combined. In Oregon, approximately 17,100 persons sustain a TBI each year, and of that number, approximately 13,500 are treated in our emergency departments and released. 600 of them die, and about 2,800 require hospitalization. The cost of just this hospital care alone for those folks who come into the ER and are hospitalized is approximately $75 million. Survivors, nearly 1,000 each year, live with significant disabilities as a result of injury. And that's really a key piece. Because the department knows very little about how most of the people are injured in Oregon, it cannot develop, target, or measure the effectiveness of prevention strategies. In addition, there is difficulty in providing outreach and follow-up to the victims over time to assure that they are connected to very much needed community services. A registry would help the department develop and evaluate brain injury prevention programs and assist in connecting brain-injured survivors to services. We also recommend amendments to the bill and have submitted those along with our testimony. Hopefully you have those. Our recommendations are to delete sections 8 through 13 and add new language that would reestablish the Oregon Task Force on Brain Injury to oversee the completion of a needs assessment and make recommendations regarding the coordination and financing of services needed in Oregon. The department supports the concept of developing a registry and exploring opportunities for services for people with traumatic brain injuries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're up.
My name is Senator Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Lori Lindberg. I'm manager of developmental disabilities licensing with seniors and people with disabilities. I was simply asked to be along today in case any questions came up around some of the proposed amendments or why we felt it was appropriate to have mental health and developmental disabilities deleted from the bill at this time, though I think Sherry spoke to that when she... Okay. I can answer any questions.
Senator Clarno and I had a bill two sessions ago that would require people under 18, individuals to wear helmets when they're riding a bicycle, a skateboard, a scooter. And one legislator in the House to wear a helmet while he was taking a shower. And I won't say who that was. But that was interesting because in Springfield, the incident was that this young man was coming down a hill, a steep hill, on a scooter and hit a truck, and he didn't have a helmet on and killed him.
Yeah.
And a similar incident happened in Bend or near where Senator Clarno lived, and the same thing resulted. And so it became apparent fairly quickly that, you know, when you see some of the things that young people do, the... extreme sports now with, you know, with help, now they're wearing helmets, but it's extremely dangerous. So we did make some strides, but it's a tragedy to do it, and that's unfortunately what usually has to happen. We talk about something for a long time until something terrible happens, and then everybody wakes up and say, well, gee, we should have done something a long time ago. Now I think that's what's motivating the brain injury. You know, I mean, the war and other things now are calling attention to the fact, but still we have the domestic incidents and young people who are subject to brain injury and so on. So it's a multifaceted problem. So, but thank you very much for being here. Let's see. Oh, okay. Greg Warnick and Andrew Ellis.
Greg Warnock.
Warnock. Is Greg here?
No, he's not.
Oh. How about Andrew Ellis? Oh, Andrew Ellis. Okay. Good.
Chairman Morissette, committee members, thanks very much for having me here with you today. My name is Andrew Ellis. I'm a clinical psychologist with a specialty in rehab psychology. And for the past 6.5 years, I've served as the clinical director of the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center at Progressive Rehab Associates, which is a freestanding clinic in Southwest Portland. My clinic is the premier post-acute brain injury rehab facility in the Northwest, and we provide cognitive rehabilitation and a range of other services for survivors of brain injury. And during the past 6 years, I've worked with approximately 400 survivors and their families. And I'm here today to offer my perspective gained from these experiences in support of Senate Bill 617. Now, the typical brain injury survivor is on a search for answers. And the kinds of questions that survivors seek the answers to include, why can't they handle their jobs anymore? Why do they lose their temper so easily with the people they care about the most? Why do their spouses and family and friends feel like strangers? Why do they hear other folks whispering about how different they seem? Why their memories fail them so often? Why they can no longer follow the plot of a fairly straightforward 30-minute TV show? Why they feel so exhausted after a simple 10-minute telephone conversation? Why they get seasick riding in a moving car? Why they get overwhelmed in Costco and end up sitting alone waiting for their families to finish shopping? And why they've started to wonder whether it might not have been better for everyone if they hadn't survived at all. Families have their questions as well. Why didn't their doctors warn them how hard folks would be once they get discharged from the hospital to live with? Who will watch their family members when they go back to work as the medical bills mount? Isn't there someone who can help us once we're discharged from the hospital? The help seems to stop. Why did it take us 2 years to find that help? And why won't my insurance company pay for that help once we found it? Survivors and families often take months and years to get questions like these answered and to find the help that they need. And often, as I mentioned, only to learn that their insurance companies will not fund the most effective and efficient post-acute treatment for these injuries. Cognitive rehabilitation may be a term that not everyone's familiar with, but it involves the application of several therapeutic disciplines simultaneously: rehabilitation medicine, occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, and clinical psychology, working closely together in a systematic and integrated effort to improve cognitive functioning, help people's ability to manage such challenges as work, marriage, parenting, independent living as a whole. Well, some of our nation's largest insurance companies, the commercial insurers, continue to challenge the efficacy of this treatment, citing literature that's outdated, incomplete, despite over 700 scientific studies to the contrary. Without the support of commercial insurers like Kaiser Permanente, workers' compensation insurers like Safe Corporation, my clinic surely would not exist any longer. And in fact, is the remnants of a program that was cut by the legacy health system in the year 2000 because it simply didn't, it wasn't fiscally viable for a large hospital system to keep any longer. And now the United States has thousands of brain injured soldiers returning or soon to return from the Middle East, and people like Sergeant Alec Geese, who's sitting to my right here. Now, Alec received top-notch brain injury rehab through the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto after a year and a half of searching for answers to the questions that I posed earlier. And the folks in Palo Alto knew that he would need more help integrating back into his family, into his community, when he left Palo Alto and headed back to his home near Cannon Beach. And who did they contact to help him? They contacted Sherry Stock at the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and she sent them to me. And to me, that's a perfect example of how brain injury survivors need not only resources, but access and direction to those resources. In conclusion, I believe that SB 617 will play that role for the people of Oregon by promoting the provision of information on TBI, by establishing focal points of contact, like Sherry Stock and others, and by supporting the provision of housing, rehab, and other services for brain injury survivors and their families. Thank you very much.
Somebody turn off their BlackBerry, please. Questions? Comments? Thank you. Thank you. Alex, would you come up, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Alec Geese, former platoon sergeant for the 52nd Engineers out of Albany, Oregon. And I don't have anything prepared to speak.
So I do have a
okay, your name was on the list, and that's why right. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So Alec introduced himself. And so I'm just going to read his paper that he was written before. I was a member of the Oregon National Guard, and I suffered a traumatic brain injury in Iraq in December 2003. My head injury was not diagnosed immediately due to other trauma. I was deployed to Iraq with the National Guard. While stationed there, I created the Houses of Hope program for displaced Iraqis. Living in a war zone, I feared biological weapons but not brain injury. Yet during a training mission, my truck hit an oil slick and lost control. The driver was killed and I was left unconscious, pinned underneath the truck. Thanks to the efforts of my soldiers who lifted the truck 3 inches, I survived. I was taken to several hospitals for observation, but it was not until I arrived home that my wife, Shauna, noticed the changes. I slept often and didn't want to see anyone. Traumatic brain injury can be missed, especially when other injuries are present. It took me a while to accept that I had a brain injury, even though I was aware of my symptoms. I eventually had a neuropsychological assessment and have since had speech, physical, and vision therapy. I have learned to read, count, change, and drive with the aid of a simulator all over again. Even though I attracted national attention in a Nightline special and in a People magazine article, I am having trouble getting the support and benefits I need. I have a 30% disability rating, and the consequences of my brain injury have seriously affected my life. I feel unable to work, but I do not meet the requirements for unemployment benefits, and my family is facing financial difficulties while I struggle to receive my benefits or prove myself able to be retrained for a new job. I experience fatigue and fear, often overwhelmed by noise, activity, and people. I am quick to get angry, and my wife and 2 teenage children have had to adjust to my behavior. I do best with routine, quiet, and being with my family at home. This presentation is very difficult for me. I realize my limitations, but I continue to learn, accept, and adjust. Since coming home, I have worked with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon to educate the public on brain injury, speaking at their annual conferences on how my family and I are dealing with this change to our lives. The BIA has been my advocate, helping me and my family navigate the federal systems. I want to say, too, that Alec has been denied Social Security disability again and has worked a long time trying to get into the VA system. And the VA, the state of Oregon came, and the VA, Oregon VA did come to their assistance and help them financially when the federal government wouldn't. From the legislation that was passed last session, sorry.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Alice. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's the stories like these that show us how much we need to do to take care of those who have these kinds of injuries, and in particular those who have actually served our countries.
David Cracky and Jerry Cohen, please.
Senator Morissette and committee members, thank you very much. My name is David Cracky. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Nichols & Associates in Portland. I've been a member, and I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Brain Injury Association. I've been practicing law since 1990 in the state of Oregon, with a practice that's focused on representing many brain-injured individuals. As a result, I've come to know many individuals suffering from the effects of traumatic brain injuries, and I've learned through them that there are many common experiences that most TBI sufferers share. A person suffering from a brain injury is at an inherent disadvantage when it comes to understanding their situation and understanding what resources might be available to help them.
The TBI sufferer typically feels isolated and alone, and these feelings can lead to a type of social paralysis that makes it extremely difficult for them to become motivated to search out the providers of services and benefits that may help them. As a result, many TBI sufferers fail to receive the information available to them regarding those services and benefits that may help them cope with the effects of their injuries. Some TBI sufferers are lucky. They call myself, they call other qualified attorneys, they call Sherry, they call friends who direct them to the Brain Injury Association, where they receive information about the services available to them. They receive information about medical specialists in the area who can help them and who help TBI sufferers routinely with the recovery process. They receive information about Social Security and other benefits available to them, and they receive information about the existence of brain injury support groups in their area. Once they learn of these benefits and the services, they realize that they are not alone in their struggle and that there may be social, professional, and financial support available to them that they otherwise would not have recognized. I know that many TBI sufferers are not so lucky as to find their way to the Brain Injury Association, and they suffer alone and isolated, and quite frankly, hope eludes them at that point. And this is a real problem, and it's one that Senate Bill 617 solves. And this is why I'm here this afternoon testifying in support of Senate Bill 617. Senate Bill 617 mandates the creation of a registry with the goal of identifying those individuals who suffer from traumatic brain injury within the state of Oregon. And then once identified, DHS would then send those individuals a packet of information describing brain injuries in general and providing TBI sufferers with contact information in order to receive additional information on the services and benefits available to them and to their family. With this information, the brain-injured individual and their family members will have direct access to the information that could dramatically improve their lives. They will have the information necessary to discover those resources available to them regarding medical services, social services, community services, and legal services. They will realize they're not alone. They'll realize they're not isolated. They'll realize that other people in the state are suffering in the same way that they are, and that there are people, organizations, and professionals available to help them through the recovery process. Another aspect of the Senate Bill 617 that I want to mention is the increase in TBI prevention awareness that it will create. Under the bill, DHS may conduct studies to identify TBI hazards, as has been already mentioned, and to identify TBI hazard remedies. The bill provides an ounce of prevention that, in the case of TBI sufferers, is worth not a pound but tons of cure. Traumatic brain injury is called the invisible injury, because a person suffering from a brain injury typically doesn't tend to look all that injured. Similarly, the services and benefits available to the TBI sufferer should not be the invisible benefits. These benefits should be made known to the TBI sufferer as soon as possible after the injury, and Senate Bill 617 provides the mechanism for this to happen. I ask you to please support Senate Bill 617 and to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, so that the people suffering from brain injuries will know that there are benefits, services, and professionals available to help them cope with the terrible effects of their injuries, and that although they may feel alone and isolated, in fact, there's a network of dedicated people waiting to help them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Jerry Cohen.
Senator Morissette, committee members, thank you. My name is Jerry Cohen, and I was admitted to the Oregon State Bar in 1975. I sustained a traumatic brain injury in a September 2001 automobile accident. At the time of my accident, I maintained the only law office in Creswell, working as a sole practitioner, and was serving on the Creswell City Council. I received no information about brain injury and was not told what to expect as a result of my concussion, categorized on the Glasgow Coma Scale as mild, upon being discharged from the hospital. One of the emergency room doctors who treated me even failed to mention the fact I had been unconscious in his consultation report. His impression of my condition in that report was, and I quote, "Multiple trauma, broke her ribs, hematuria, nothing bad." I was thus totally unprepared for the total mental chaos I experienced upon my return to work. I returned to my office on a part-time basis and resumed my civic duties as soon as my physical injuries allowed, while continuing in physical therapy for several months.
11 months after the accident, I underwent a neuropsychological evaluation because my symptoms remained unresolved and was subsequently advised by my neurologist to terminate my law practice based on the results of the test. I was devastated by the reality that I could no longer engage in the profession for which I was trained and continue doing the only work I had done during my 27-year adult working life. After 6 months of applying for jobs, doing such things as flipping hamburgers and cleaning pet cages, I sought help from the Oregon Voc Rehab Services. Before embarking upon the job search phase of the program, I was the beneficiary of state-funded vision therapy, cognitive rehabilitation, and grief counseling, none of which were covered by my health insurance and would otherwise have been unavailable to me. The final hurdle I had to cross before becoming eligible for job search assistance was demonstrating my ability to work a minimum of 20 hours per week for a period of 30 to 90 days. I was fortunate enough to secure a volunteer position at the Brain Injury Association of Oregon as a means of satisfying that condition. My file was ultimately closed as it became evident within 4 to 6 weeks that I was unable to work the hours required on a sustained basis. Upon the termination of my volunteer position, I became a member of the Brain Injury Association Board of Directors and continue in that capacity. During the time I was a volunteer at the Brain Injury Association, I learned much about traumatic brain injury. I credit much of my recovery to two things. First, my voc rehab counselor understood brain injury and went out on a limb to arm me with as many tools as possible to maximize my chances of success in returning to work. Second, the assistance I received from the Brain Injury Association and the support groups to which I belong were instrumental in helping me adjust to my loss and accept the person I was becoming. There is little doubt in my mind I would still be floundering today if I continued to be unaware of the Brain Injury Association and the vital role it plays in educating both professionals and the general public and the about brain injury and in providing support to TBI survivors, their families, and the professionals charged with assisting them. I only wish the Brain Injury Association had the means at its disposal to reach every returning brain-injured American soldier and the over 17,000 Oregonians who sustain brain injuries every year so they, too, could experience the improved quality of life I enjoy as a result of my association with that organization. On a slightly different note, my daughter, Andrea Moon, wanted to speak to you but couldn't be here. She resumed her academic career in the fall of 2005 after a four-year hiatus and is taking an anatomy and physiology exam at Lane Community College. She felt it is important that you understand how my accident impacted her and the other five members of my family. She writes, "I am an affected family member of a TBI survivor, my mom. Before she was injured, I didn't have any idea that brain injuries could happen to someone I love. I thought they were something that happened to race car drivers, football players, and horse jumpers. Before my mom even left the emergency room, I had assumed the role of her parent. I made all of her medical decisions for her, and once we were released, I made her care my priority over work and school. I took over all the household chores, made sure she was bathed and medicated, and drove her to all of her doctor and physical therapy appointments. At this point, I hadn't even realized the emotional impact. My mom wasn't the only one that lost something that day. Everyone that cared for her lost a little piece of something that day, too. Life was going to be different from that moment on."
Thank you. Have you noticed changes, continued changes?
Many. Again, a lot of it depends on my fatigue level.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm really tired, I can't get two words out straight. Because it was an auto accident, I remain really anxious sometimes when I'm driving. Mm-hmm. Again, fatigue level being high, I'm more anxious, less fatigue. I can sort of self-talk and talk my way through things.
Mm-hmm.
The fatigue remains a really, really major problem.
Maybe the injury hasn't changed, but your ability to adapt has changed.
Right. I did, after I took the neurological neuropsych, and before I got the results, I spent a week at the brain injury rehab center that Andy Ellis spoke of. Mm-hmm. The goal at that time was to teach me some tools and strategies to help me in, you know, with the goal of maintaining my law practice, which we thought was still viable at that point. The cognitive rehab I obtained a couple years later through the Voc Rehab program was down in Eugene. So I've had the benefit of a lot of that. And yes, there were some tools I've been given. I sort of have developed an affirmation which sometimes I stop believing, but I oft repeat to myself, particularly when I do stop believing, and that is, I remain an intelligent human being. I merely process things differently and more slowly.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Both of you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Senator Bridger.
Would you agree that when people go through a kind of trauma, there is an almost desperation to find someone to help you?
I didn't know anything was wrong. Everything I had been told led me to believe I was going to be just fine. So I floundered for a year with my law practice, and looking back, I am grateful to some very understanding clients. Mm-hmm. And it was not until after I closed the office and went up to the Brain Injury Rehab Center alumni support group about a year and a half after my accident that I even became aware of how isolated I'd become. Mm-hmm. Until I was around a group of people who I could understand what I was trying to say, mm-hmm. which non-impaired persons, and they couldn't quite grasp it. And I, until that point, I had no clue.
Thank you for that answer.
Thank you. We have a few more people to speak. Carol Christopher Snyder and Randall. And then we have Amy Rem. Okay, this will be our last panel, and we are going to have to be out of here by 5, and we are going to hopefully move the SJR. Yeah, we'll do that.
I brought a prop. Mr. Snyder, I don't think has signed up to pop. You thought I brought your pop? No, just a prop. But I wanted you to see what someone who in the beginning didn't look like he was very injured, but through the years has deteriorated. He has a scar from the top of his head from ear to ear from neurosurgery at the VA in San Francisco. He has lost his left eye, which is very common right now with the injuries coming back from Iraq. Mr. Snyder stepped on a landmine now called IEDs in the Iraq War in 1968 in Vietnam after 28 days of being in the country. When his parents sent him off in the Marine Corps, his parents believed that if he got hurt and he came home, that he would be taken care of. And this has proven to be absolutely not true. Granted, in 1968, there was very little out there about brain injury. They sent him home with Dilantin, said, I hope you don't have a seizure and come back and we'll do some surgery on your eye. They were very intent about that. As time went on and I grew and we had a couple children, I realized that something was very wrong with his ability to plan, to think ahead, to discipline the children, to retain a job. I can't tell you, I think I've counted up 18 jobs that he's had, always being fired because he was not able to follow through. I went to the VA and said something's wrong with this man in 1975. They gave him a short test and said, oh, he's fine. Yes, because he has a high IQ. He was very strong, and he can tell you who the last 5 presidents were and who the vice president was and what time it is today. But he can't tell you what he wants to do 2 days from now. 1988, I read an article in the paper about a place called Community Rehab, which was Emmanuel Hospital, that had an outpatient program. And I worked for 2 years with Senator Packwood to get VA to pay for Mr. Snyder to go to this program. He was the first veteran in the Portland area that the VA was paying outside of the limited sources, which were none, that they had. Mr. Snyder spent 2 years there, made great progress, but again, with a neuropsych exam, it became clear that he was not going to be the breadwinner of the family, nor was he going to be the partner that I thought that I had married. He still, to this day, goes to PRA. He sees Dr. Smith there and Doug Peterson, who's an occupational therapist, and this has been going on since 1988. I guess what I'm here to tell you is there is a trail to help rehabilitate, even though people will never be the same person they are. But their quality of life can be regenerated. It will be different. It won't be the same, but they can have a good quality of life. The Veterans Administration is not willing. So out of this, I joined the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, which was a small organization at the time. I was president of the board at one time. I've served on their advisory board. In 1998, I was appointed to Governor Kitzhaber's panel on brain injury. We had a bill almost identical to this that we tried to pass at that time and got very little response because there was not a lot of empathy for people with brain injuries. So I'm here to say that this has got to happen because these fellows are coming home. They're ending up in our prison systems. They're ending up on the streets. They're ending up killing people. They're ending up taking their own lives. Mr. Snyder will tell you that there was a time in his life that he felt it would have been better if he died. So I guess I'm here to tell you, as a wife who also has not been able to pursue the career that I wanted to because I have had to take off and work part-time in order to take care of our children and to spend many, many hours of advocating through the senator's offices, through the Veterans Administration, in order to get Mr. Snyder the services. He has the creme de la creme services that are available, but it's only been because of the tenacity of myself and our now grown children that he has done that. We have a family joke that when they bring Mr. Snyder's file out, which comes out in a wheelbarrow, that they open it up and a little flag, and excuse my French, pops up and says, "Wife is a bitch, wife is a bitch, wife is a bitch, just do what you need for her to do." And that's what I have had to many times turn into in order to get the services that we need. We have met Alec and his wife. They are now starting down the same road that we started 37 years ago, and I don't see it being much different. So I am here to tell you that it is very important that we take care of these veterans and the people that are in motorcycle accidents and fall off of cliffs and do those things. Mr. Snyder will never be the Mr. Snyder that he could have been, but he is at this point living a somewhat decent quality of life with two wonderful daughters who probably take better care of him than I do because I get more irritated faster than they do. And I am just, I guess, pleading to you as a spouse that this needs to be taken care of. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Amy? That is a hard act to follow.
Yes.
Chairman Morissette and Senators, thank you for having us. My name is Amy Weem. I'm an Oregon physician. As an anesthesiologist, I, as you probably know, I make life and death decisions every minute when I'm at work. I had a traumatic brain injury 1 year ago, and as a result, I'm not able to practice medicine now because I can't make fast, complex decisions. I thought I was an educated healthcare consumer as well as provider. I have health insurance, and yet I'm here to tell you how hard it was for me to get timely and good healthcare because the physicians in the community do not know enough about TBI, and there's really no place for them to get the information. You've heard about all this already today. And when I went to the emergency room, I had not had any loss of consciousness. but I had common symptoms of TBI. I had headache and double vision. I had vertigo, nausea, and I felt like I was underwater. And my CT scan showed that I'd had a bleed in my brain. And I saw so many doctors in the first week. It was all uncoordinated, helter-skelter. Nobody told me there was a treatment for vertigo. Nobody told me about the Brain Injury Association. Nobody told me about support groups. And as other people have said, it was only through slow persistence that I was able to get treatment. And I never got any screening testing until months and months later when I was sent for neuropsych testing. I also had a follow-up MRI at 3 months point, which was normal. And at that point, the neurologist who was looking after me said, your MRI is normal. You can go back to work. Never had neuropsych testing, never had any screening, never had any... So people's understanding sort of gets to a point and then falls off. And they need education, and they need some kind of a resource that makes it easy for them to do their job better. And I think that the Brain Injury Association is the obvious point. And I would say that it was the very nature of my injury that made it hard to initiate actions of research and self-education and to advocate for myself. And that's what happens with other people, is that when your brain isn't working very well, it's very hard to advocate for yourself. So you need other people to do it for you. And nobody really knows what cognitive therapy is, but you get, at least my experience is, you are given very, very simple exercises to do, manipulating numbers and letters, listening, writing, and then progressively gets more complicated and more difficult as you succeed. There are people who have such scrambled brains that they can't write a series of numbers as dictated to them. And they practice and they practice and they help their brain remember how to work. And that's what cognitive therapy does. And it brings people back from, as you'll see in the CDs that you have, from not being able to recognize a hammer to being able to speak English fluently and function and do one's job. And what else did I want to tell you? Oh, yes. If you think about this, I live in Portland. I live near the hub of medical care in Oregon, and that's how hard it was for me to get good care. So think about how difficult it is for people who don't have insurance, don't live near the city, and may not even have the same amount of personal resource. And you have a lot of people who could do better, who could be more productive citizens, but who are not. They're just left isolated, and I have to say in the beginning I felt very panicky and suicidal at some points because I didn't see any way out. I didn't see how I was going to take care of myself. And nobody even asked me the right questions. And it was just slow, took time, slow time, and I'm getting better.
So what's your prognosis?
I am getting better on a regular basis, slowly. Improvement seems to happen over a matter of years for brain injury, not like a broken leg, which I've had. 1 year, 3 year, 5 years. Progress has been noted by many people up to 10 years. I do not know whether I will return to the operating room at this time. The risk to patients is so great that I think I have to be extra cautious in that, but I do hope to do something productive.
Now, do brain cells in a brain injury die? Is it destruction of brain cells? Or
In some cases it is.
The synapse is disturbed or what?
In some cases it is, but it's also thought that individual neurons can be twisted, sheared, stretched, or some other description that injures them that doesn't show up on MRIs.
Okay. Is there any is stem cell a possibility? Is that part of the research for brain injury, I wonder?
I don't honestly know.
Yeah. I can answer that probably.
Okay.
They have been doing stem cell research, and right now the research has been focusing on Parkinson's, which is always in the same part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've already done this with a number of people, including Michael J. Fox, where they inject the stem cells into the area that has Parkinson's. And they're not sure if this at this time if it's new, the stem cells have overwritten the bad brain cells, or if they're just there in conjunction and what it's going to be in the long term. But right now it has shown to have significant influence and controlled the shaking that Parkinson's has. It's the shaking. So what it means in the future for brain injury, I think it probably means a good future for brain injury, but that's not going to be in the foreseeable future.
But you have to remember hope. That the brain is the most complex organ in the body, and it can be injured in an infinite number of ways. And I like the expression the Brain Injury Association has. If you've seen one brain injury, you've seen one brain injury. Mm-hmm. Because everybody's a little bit different, and that's why you really need professionals who have an education about it. And also, when you have a brain injury, there's nothing else on your mind.
Now, doctor, are there specialties today that did not exist a few years ago in dealing with brain injuries? Or
I think specialties, I don't think so. Okay. Rehabilitation medicine has been in existence for some time. Mm-hmm. There is exactly one rehabilitation medicine specialist in Oregon who specializes in brain injury. She's already busy. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen when
okay.
all the veterans come back and need help. And
yeah, because she's covering them too.
Yeah.
There is.
Ooh,
there.
We've got to go. Sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you.
I lost track of time. This room is going to be. Someone's coming in here.
So we're just gonna,
and then we have to go to another.
Yeah, Trudy is just going to kind of round it up.
Okay, Trudy. And then we're going to pass out the SJR.
I'm Trudy Smith, Government Affairs with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. I'm going to be real brief. We have a single paper that's offering the amendments to this bill.
Okay.
Because of drafting errors, as I was mentioned before, it just wasn't completed right. We feel that we need everything in these amendments to make the program go. We just can no longer provide lip service. We feel that the state of Oregon needs its time to step up to the plate and do something and be of service to our people with one of the worst disabilities you could probably have. So this particular paper that says delete sections 8 through 15 found on pages 3 to 12 and then add da-da-da-da. So if you have any questions, you can either call Sherry or I.
We'll reschedule.
Yeah. But they need to be sent to LC.
Yeah. Well, once they're out, we'll read.
Thank you very much.
We'll have a work session. Okay. Thank you. So we will close the public hearing. That was my CD. I didn't hit it though. Didn't cause any injury to it. Close the public hearing on 617, Senate Bill 617, and we will open a N. And we'll close the public hearing on SJR 21, and we'll open a work session on SJR 21.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 21 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah.
He adopted, excuse me. You're right.
So where have you been?
I was sitting right next to you most of the time.
Senator Cruz moves SJR 21 be adopted and sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Comments? Okay. So ordered. I will carry the ball.
Now you can adjourn. Thank you.